Hello, 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 Fabi Fab here, and today I bring you a very special episode of Latinos Who Lunch live at Fuse Box Festival. So this past April, Babelito and I were in Austin, Texas, and we did a live show at UT Austin, and then the next day, we did a live show for Fuse Box. So the festival does these really awesome, what they call waffle chats, so kind of like panel discussions. And they eat waffles and have coffee in the morning. And so there's this place called The Hub where everything kind of happened. And I actually did a big installation called Cuvole on the outside of The Hub, made it look like a big piñata. So that's where this took place. So just so you can picture it, think of a beautiful, bright, sunny spring Austin, Texas day. And they set up a tent and chairs, and it was just a wonderful crowd. It was so many great people, and we had a panel of artists and cultural influencers. I don't know if I like the word influencer. Cultural producers there, and I'm not going to tell you about them now because I introduced them live on the show. You're about to hear that, but it was a very interesting topic. So all of us were Latinos, and all of us were white passing. So we talked about white passing privilege, white passing Latinidad for this chat. So yeah, without further ado, I'm going to play it and then I'll be back with a few announcements at the end. Hello, hello, hello.
Show.
This is where you clap, everyone. Hey. Oh my goodness, thank you so much. Austin, Texas, Mexico, how are you? Oh my goodness. Fusebox has been amazing. Thank you so much to everyone, yes, that has organized this. I've had one of the best weeks here in Austin. This community is so awesome and white. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So I'm so excited to get this started. And so... In my white announcer voice, oh my God. God's trying to block it. Okay. I'm going to introduce our guests, but first, a little bit about ourselves. I'm Fabi Fav from the podcast Latinos Who Lunch.
And I'm Babelito, also from the podcast Latinos Who Lunch.
We do a weekly podcast where we talk about identity, race, pop culture,
food,
whatever the fuck we want. Because, oh, there's kids. Whatever the heck we want. Oh, you have headphones in. Smart parent. Okay. Because when I started listening to podcasts, I was trying to hear queer voices, queer Latino voices, just two people talking about whatever, and I just couldn't find it. There was a lot of really amazing black queer podcasts like The Read or Another Round. But
For Color Nerds.
For Color Nerds is one of my favorites. And so we just started recording. And 3 years later, here we are, still coming out with episodes. And actually, through the podcast, forming an incredible community. And I recognize a lot of you in the audience from previous live tapings or from the internet. So thank you all for coming. Okay, now, without further ado, the moment you've all been waiting for. Educator and president of MASS, Aaron Gentry. She's also DJ for the Chulita Vinyl Club. You might have heard of them. President, director, curator, executive producer of the Museum of Pocket Art, and artist, Roberto Jackson Harrington. Come on up. Come on down. All right. And now, professor and artist, Alexandra Robinson. National coordinator for Live in America and academic, Kara Martinez.
Okay, so
here we are to talk about some uncomfortable topics, but that's what we do in the podcast. I want to know, before we get started, I want us to, you guys to, we are, Fabi already introduced yourselves, but tell us a little bit more about what you do and how you're participating with Fusebox before we get into the good stuff.
Okay, I'll start.
Okay.
Hello, everybody. My name's... Hello.
Hello.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming out. My name is Robert Jackson Harrington. I'm the executive director of the Museum of Pocket Art. I'm also a visual artist and a curator. And that's good for now.
Hi, I'm Kara Martinez. I work for Fusebox Festival on a new project called Live in America, and I teach in the Department of Theater and Dance at the University of Texas.
Oh, my name is Erin Gentry, and I'm the president of Mass Gallery, and I'm also a DJ with Chulita Vinyl Club, and I also am a bilingual educator. I work in College Access for Breakthrough Central Texas, working with students who will be the first in their families to go to college.
I'm Alex Robinson, and I am an educator at St. Edward's University in the Visual Studies Department in Art, and I'm also a visual artist.
Amazing. So we're here today to talk about some uncomfortable stuff, and that's like our favorite thing to do on Latinos Who Lunch. So I actually want to give a shout out to Jaime Castillo, because when we were talking about what topic we should cover today, he said, I want to hear a conversation about white passing Latinos, because I've never heard that before. And I said, yes, let's do it. So this is something that I have been thinking about lately a lot. And, you know, on our podcast, we talk about representation in media a lot. And I wasn't aware of my white passing appearance until like last year, right? And so I've come to terms with that. I've accepted it. And I feel like... I think it's like a really honest reaction. I've actually felt like offended when I was like, what? I'm white? And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is probably what white people feel like all the time when their whiteness is pointed out, right? Because that's the one thing that I know is like white people hate when you talk about whiteness because they're like, I'm not white, I'm Jewish, or I'm not white, I'm, you know,
gay.
Yeah. Ugh. The worst. Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so, you know, colorism is real, y'all, and we need to acknowledge it. If you're a person that says you don't see color, then I hope you're blind, because that's fucking bullshit, right? If you don't see color, you need to open your eyes. You need to realize there's a big racism. There's a big race problem here in America. White supremacy is strong. And it's not only with different races. It's within our own community. I just want to kind of start off by talking about maybe when y'all came to the realization, y'all, see, I'm from Texas already.
Yeah.
when y'all came to the realization of this dynamic, when you saw your whiteness.
I can go ahead and start. I am white. I don't even identify as white passing. Just because I feel like it's really important for me to acknowledge the unearned privileges that I have as a white person living in the United States. So I was like actually a little bit uncomfortable with the blurb of this talk, because it was like, but they don't identify as white. And I was like, I do, you know, I'm not trying to fool anybody. But because I do think it's like it's important to talk about that, I can't really identify a time when I didn't feel white, you know. When I moved over from Mexico and I became, you know, living in the United States, maybe was the time when I realized that I was white, because in my family, everybody looks like me, but they live in Mexico and we're just Europeans that live in Mexico. So I guess it's like, yeah, I never had that moment where I was like, oh my God, I'm white. But I do have to come out to people as being Mexican every day.
Well, for me, I grew up in El Paso, and everyone
Chuco.
Around me, Chuco Town.
Nobody else.
Lower Valley Punk. Anybody? Anyway. grew up in El Paso. Everyone around me was Latino or brown. And so I just...
Speaking to the mic.
I just thought of myself as being brown, except one time I remember playing at a friend's house and overhearing the parents talking that they were so excited that their mijito, their little brown boy, was friends with the white kid. And I was like, what? Like, I didn't realize that I was the white kid. It never occurred to me until, like, at that point. And I was like, oh, I'm wait a minute, I'm different. Like, that was, I think, the early part when I, as far back as, like, elementary school, I think, is when it started.
Well, I grew up in the military, so I had a totally different experience in terms of, like, who you belong to, where you belong, because I grew up everywhere. And but the result of that was that I didn't belong anywhere. And so, like, we would come home to visit family here in Texas, and I didn't quite fit. And then we would go, you know, wherever we were living. And we, I don't know, as I got older, like, my appearance seems to fall into many different cultures that come from mixed intersectional families. So I get spoken to in many different languages. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic that I still struggle with it, but I think it's very interesting. Living here, I'm definitely dealing with it in a different way now, and I think that's really interesting.
I was like 4 or 5. Oh. And I grew up in rural East Texas, which is profoundly rural. It's not particularly, everyone's like, ay. There's not a large Latinx population. We were the only Mexican family where I grew up. My dad would be like, you're Mexican. But I also knew I wasn't quite Mexican. So I would tell people that I was half Mexican and half plain. because I didn't know what white was. I was like, it just feels very plain to me. And my dad loved it. So he just, like, kept coaching it. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I think, so it's a process. And race, as my friend Kirsten says, Kirsten Pye Buick, it's something that we do and perform to each other. And the way that we perform race in Latin America is different than the way that we perform race here in the United States. And the way that we perform race in Mexico, growing up there, was very different. It's based on class. So I always was aware of class from the moment I can remember. And I think for me was going to El Paso High School, to Monwood High School, and that's when I was like, oh, shit. There's categories, and I don't fit in any of them. What the fuck does that mean? Then I've been thinking about it. But it was in grad school that I was confronted with, not so much with my white passing, but with my privileges, and that means class, gender, all of it, that it was difficult. It was like a series of things. But with that perception in mind, the idea of performing race to each other, how have you been made aware of your whiteness by the performance of other people's onto you? That I have a question for you guys.
I think that, so I grew up in Las Vegas, and it's a very diverse city, but, you know, diverse when it comes to the census, but when you look at the neighborhoods, a lot of cities in the United States are very segregated. They're more segregated now than they were in the mid-century. So I grew up in a Mormon neighborhood, a white Mormon neighborhood, and so most of my friends were super white. we had a lot of Jell-O in those days. And so... they can throw down, though. They put a bunch of stuff in it. Okay, so...
Grapes.
Floating fruit. So I was the token Mexican, even though I'm also half Guatemalan. Central America exists, everybody. Don't erase Central America.
Can I jump in real quick?
Yeah.
Like, you were saying you were the Mexican. Like, you... That holds the place for all of Latin America, for a lot of white people.
Exactly. So right. That's the default Latino in the Southwest. Everybody called me the funny Mexican guy. And so that's what I was. And that's what I performed, like Babelito was saying. And so it didn't come to my attention until recently because of our podcast and me listening to more like socially aware podcasts. I was listening to the podcast Tea with Queen and Jay. And... they are incredible, two black feminist race nerds that always talk about colorism because one of them is super light-skinned and one of them is a dark black person. So they were talking about Gina Rodriguez and how she is white passing because she could play an Italian on TV. And I said, oh my God, I could be J-Lo's cousin in an Italian movie, right? So they brought that to my attention. And when I met them in person, they said the same thing to me. They're like, okay, spicy Italian in the house, right? And so that was shocking to me, but at the same time, it made so much sense. Having white passing privilege or just being lighter skinned than the person next to you does give you certain advantages. And so I think being aware of that is so important because, you know, you can take that privilege and use it for good and not for evil, right? And a lot of us that are lighter skinned Latinos or people of color don't realize that we're stepping on other people and getting more opportunities because we're not the scary, loud, dark one, you know? And that's fucked up to say, but it's just the truth that we live in right now. So back to you, back to performing identity and performing race. Does anybody want to chime in about that?
Well, I just wanted to add that I think that when race is performing onto us in a certain way where we're tokenized because we're the Mexican or we're the Latino or we're this and that, that in a way erases a little bit of the privilege that we have because we othered ourselves. Like when they do that to us, we become the other and we forget about our privileges. Yeah. And that's something that I hear all the time. There is a Chilean singer that I used to love and now I can't fucking stand, Alexander Anwanter, that in this new album that he came out, it's all about like, but I'm Latino Americano. I'm like, no, girl, you're white Chilean. Like, and you used to do albums about being white Chilean, and I stand behind those more than fucking him trying to empathize with a pain that is not yours, which is so, so frustrating. But back to it, so how do you play with those dynamics?
Well, for me, labeling, I think, is prominent in how we navigate through social structures. So growing up, I'm the original Beto from El Paso. All right. My mom's from Mexico. So growing up, my immediate family, I was Betito. Like, my cousins and stuff call me Beto. Like, and then, like, in high school, I was Rob. So I became more white as cooler, you know, like
Bobbert.
No, I hated Bobby. Don't ever call me Bobby. Okay, here we go.
In like the talking about the nickname. So like my name is Aaron, which is an Irish name. It's super duper white. And my abuela would just be like, what is going on with this name? And so she called me Irlanda, which is Ireland in Spanish, because she was like, ¿qué diablos es his name? Irlanda. Like, what does that even mean, Aaron? You know? And so when she would come to visit, my whole family would call me Irlanda. And then I would like, when she would come to visit, and I would be like, abuela, like, just try it. Like, Aaron, Erin, like, whatever. And she would be like, háblame en cristiano, which means speak to me in Christian. And I would be like, okay, heard. She's never, ever, ever said my name. She couldn't handle it. But then I had like second and third cousins who would be like, hey, Ireland. You know, like when I would go back to Mexico and I'd be like, that's too far. You can't take it from English and then into Spanish. But back in English again. If you want to do it in English, it's Aaron. You know? And so like this sort of like tension between these like, the nicknames and the names and how you use those names, I think is also really interesting.
Yeah. I was thinking about when I was maybe 7 or 8, we got a pool in our backyard. Damn. Which was next level. And my grandma Martinez freaked the fuck out. And it was the only time I ever saw her get angry at my dad. And she was like, they're gonna get tans.
Oh, yeah, negritos.
Oh, yeah, they were gonna, yeah. And she freaked out. She freaked out because it was really important that we weren't tan, because also not being tan means you're safe. Mm-hmm. And that you don't sound, it was, my dad taught Spanish. He was a Spanish teacher, but he didn't teach any of his kids Spanish. And that was also about being safe, and especially in East Texas. But I think about being, before I moved back to Austin, I worked at a very large theater institution in Minneapolis. And boy, did they love that I was white. But also had the last name Martinez. So you begin to operate. Yeah, mm-hmm. They're like, yes, she's pale. oh, we'll be so comfortable. They didn't like it that I would be loud. But you begin to operate, this thing starts to happen, I think, when you're in those institutions where you begin to operate like synecdoche. Like, I was an English teacher for high school, so I like the term. But the part, the part for the whole. So you begin to think, like, yeah, I'm a Latina. And it's like, well, that is true. But you become, like, a non-nuanced version of yourself.
Right.
And it erases your having to struggle with yourself in those kinds of spaces. Because they want you there, and they want you to perform that thing. But it begins to sort of chip away at your having to problematize yourself.
Right.
So interesting, because like just the way that I was raised, I identified as my. So in the military, are there any military people? Because like in the military, you are an extension of your father. My father's Jewish culturally. My mother's Hispanic or born in Texas but Mexican descent. I don't know. However you want to parse that out, but
Tejana.
Tejana. But I never had the privilege of the identity. Like as a person, because I was always, whatever I did was would reflect on my father, and so there was no sense of ownership. And so I think it confused me when I would come to like visit family here in Texas, because it was flipped. It was like all of a sudden the rules were my mother's family's rules, which were very patriarchal, and so like I was always in conflict, and I never understood. I mean, it took me till my 20s to respect the differences, but like I never quite got it, and I still think like it does bother me, because like, yes, white presenting, but I don't belong in that space either, because if I'm around people of color, they see something, but if I'm around white people, they think like I'm Italian. I'm Italian. Mm-hmm. I can cook some Italian food, you know, and it's like it's messy.
I think it's also really interesting to, like, because I grew up, you know, born in Mexico and then moved to the United States and lived in, like, a super white suburb of Houston. And so it is pretty comfortable for me to be in a group of, like, blonde people. As a blonde kid, like, I was like, oh, okay, no problem, you know. But I would just be really, like, bummed and disappointed when I would have friends that would, like, say super racist stuff, and I would have to, like, talk to them about that, or they would like be like grassy ass, you know, and I'd be like, do not even fucking say it like that, like that is too crazy, you know. So like this sort of like flying under the radar as someone who's super white, and then being in white communities and hearing the things that people say about Mexicans and Latinos and people of other races, it is just like pretty shocking. And I think for a while it took me like a really long time to figure out like how uncomfortable it was for me, because I was like, well, you know, these are my friends, but then this is wrong, and like, what do I do? And then it sort of started just being like, this is fucked up. Y'all are fucked up, and I don't want to be around this anymore. And so trying to really like reconnect with my, like kind of publicly connect with my like Mexicanness and my Latinidad, because at home, like we're super Mexican. When I go back to Mexico, we're super Mexican, but out in like my public life, it was like, oh no, I should just look like a white American, you know? And so really trying to like convince people that I was Mexican was something that I like do pretty much every day, where people are like, no way. And I'm like, yes way. Like,
it's say way. Sing a Selena song right now.
It's real.
Una vez. Dale.
Can't get into it.
You like triggered all these. Thing, not triggered, but sparked a bunch of ideas in my brain. But like, some touch. Like, there's a conflict between like race labeling and culture.
Yeah.
And so like, and one thing that we keep using as identifiers is food. And I think Latinos Who Lunch, that you do that helps access culture. So like, you were talking about being Italian, you cook spaghetti. You know, like I grew up. My mom's from Mexico, my dad's from New York. So I remember eating mole one day, and then pork chops and applesauce the next day. And yeah. So it's like you identify your culture with your identity, but then you get labeled race, and that's how others project. Yeah.
But
it's also how you feel out.
It's also a conduit to make fun of.
Yeah.
No te gusta el agua de horchata. What? You're Mexican. Mm. You don't like cinnamon.
I don't like Chipotle flavor.
But you like Flamin' Hot.
I do love Flamin' Hot Cheetos, though. Okay. Yeah. And so going back to what you were saying about being in spaces where people think that you're white or... I mean, I obviously don't look like full white, but I've been in places where... I've worked for a lot of nonprofits in Las Vegas, museums, galleries, Wada Wada La Cuchara, right? So the amount of times that I've had to... I didn't at first, right? When I was in my 20s, I didn't have the courage or the words to say what I was feeling. And I just... It felt really bad because I knew something was wrong and I just didn't know how to express myself. But I would sit in board meetings or just, like, planning committee meetings. And they'd be like, oh, Ernesto Gutierrez is coming. Why don't we get a taco truck and then maybe hire a mariachi band? And I'd be like...
Un pinche chihuahua.
Yeah, they're like, we'll get... Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And then we'll do, like, a Frida lookalike contest, right? And I'm like... In my heart, I was like, y'all, that's so racist, but I couldn't say anything. And now, you know, a few years of that happening, I had to be like, yo, that is not cool, right? Just because an artist is Latino doesn't mean that they want that. And so it's like a double-edged sword for me because I actually make work about... like tacos and nachos and all these foods that have been taken from us. people see that I do projects about tacos, but I really don't like tacos because I eat them all the time because of this research project that I do. And so every time I go to a new city, people are like, hey, I know where the best tacos are. I was like, that's cool, girl. I'm actually... gonna go eat at the ramen spot right up the street, right? Like, because I eat tacos every day. I eat Mexican food every day. So if I go to a new city, I want to try what's there. You know where I went when I came here? I was like, I want to go to the most chain Tex-Mex place and eat queso. I went to Chuy's, and I had a wang dang doodle. It was amazing. It was wonderful, right? So, yes, for with Latinos Who Lunch, that's a big thing for me is to show people like Babelito and I don't eat tacos every day. Like I talked about cabbage exclusively. Cabbage, I love coleslaw, and I was just talking about coleslaw for a week because you know you can get a lot of coleslaw out of one cabbage. So I was eating it for a while, and you know Babelito, he loves to make balsamic vinaigrette reductions and pour them all over vegetables that I never heard of.
Everything.
And so like, oh look at this, Latinos being multidimensional. What? They don't just eat rice and beans. What? Okay. You know. So, but yes, girl, I do love a good taco al pastor too. Like, I'm not gonna front, right? So, and now I'm just rambling about food and got really excited. Yeah. So I'm gonna calm down.
So, with that in mind, that brings me. So, one of the advantages of white passing.
Sorry.
Go for it. One of the advantages about white passing is that you get to fuck with people's perception, right? You just talked about food. I do it all the time through academia. Like, I will play Pokemon Go in front of my colleagues just to make them uncomfortable because they don't know what the fuck to do with that. Because they see this, they think that when they hire this Mexican scholar, they have these ideas and they're not there. So I like to fuck with that. How do you guys do that?
How do you fuck with everyone?
Yes.
By letting them know that I speak Spanish.
Ooh, yeah, that's good.
A classic, you know. One time when I was in high school, I was working at like a grocery store, and I heard this, you know, these two people speaking Spanish, and one was admonishing the other one for talking shit about somebody in Spanish in front of them, and that person actually spoke Spanish. And the guy was like, nunca sabes, nunca sabes cuando van a estar ahí, van a estar, you know, hablando español, te van a escuchar, nunca sabes. And I just was like, nunca sabes. And they just died, you know, they're like, see, they're everywhere.
Y'all, we're taking over.
I mean, I think it's like about normalizing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm an educator, and I have lots of students in my class. They come from different places and different experiences, and so I mean, I'm in a studio environment, so I'm with them a lot. So I kind of let them know my story, mm-hmm. and then we just start talking about food. I mean, growing up in the military, you eat from everywhere, and so the culture of my family is not just one type of food. It's a food from many places. that informs the story, you know? I don't know. That's how I look at it.
I think working with students, too, I also, like, let them know, like, my story. And then I, like, connect really strongly with the students that I have whose parents are immigrants mm-hmm. with the story of going back to Mexico or having family in Mexico or, like, the primos or the primas that you, like, have in Mexico. And that, for me, is, like, the students usually are just like, oh, whatever, white lady. And then they're like, oh, they have, you know, primos in Mexico. Like, and it's like this moment where we can connect, like, over the food or over, like, this sort of migration or immigration between the two countries over the border.
Like, well, I wanted to touch two things real quick. Was I don't have a personal anecdote of like, disruption, but growing up, we watched American Me, and Milkweed was me. Like, he was half and half, and one of his, like, they would always tell me, like, I can play both sides. I can like, get in and infiltrate the white culture. And so that was, like, they kind of expected that of me, like, to go in and mess with white culture. But building off that was that it always is welcoming when Latino or minorities find out or like, connect with me, but it's always the opposite when it's white people.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. There's, like, I feel or sense a wall go up right away. And like, code switching happens really fast, like the firm handshake, as opposed to, like, the clap or whatever. You know what I mean?
I don't know.
I feel like I have just a naughty nature in general, and that feels very Latino to me, right? Like, it's like, oh, I want to mess with this. I love now saying, well, I think our presence in any historically white institution disrupts it, like, just being there disrupts it.
Right.
But then I love saying, oh, this is my phrase I love saying. Oh, you're a good white liberal progressive. Oh, people don't like that. So I love saying it. But I...
You use their guilt.
Yeah, they're like, she said it. I was thinking about food as well. Like, we grew up with mole. I think that act of making an enchilada sauce from scratch or mole is, like, the greatest act of love in my family. Like, that's how you give people love. Or to make a tortilla with your friends, like, that's love. But at the same time, when my dad had this, like, incredible temper, and when he would get most angry is he believed that on Sundays he should have fried chicken. Because his mother, Grandma Martinez, made him fried chicken on Sundays, and my mom couldn't cook. And he would just be like, where's my fried chicken? And lose his mind. And so it was... Like, food was, like, food was, like, a center of culture, and it was all kinds of food. Like, food was how you loved somebody, how you hated them, how you welcomed them, and then you could code in and out of different kinds of food.
Aaron and I actually talked about something before we started recording, and I want to touch on that because I've been faced with a lot of white queers telling me their stories, and... I always say, but yeah, but you're white. And they're like, yeah, but I'm queer, right? So it's like this thing that happens within the queer identity that because you're a minority, because of the way that you identify within your sexual orientation or whatever you want to call it, that their whiteness, they feel like their whiteness is erased.
It disappears.
And then on the other side of that, when people talk about queer rights, LGBTQ plus rights, that is also just seen as, like, white cis male rights. And I saw this happen right before my eyes when gay marriage was legalized. All those white gays that were marching on the streets for everyone, they disappeared. They went away, they got a dog, they adopted a black child, and you didn't see them anymore. Where were they? Where were they for the Black Lives Matter rallies? Where were they for the Women's March?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't give a fuck about us. They don't care about us, right? And so that shows you how whiteness, it transcends, the queer identity, right? So you want to touch on that a little
bit? Yeah, and there's just also, like, very little, like, when I was coming out, there wasn't really, like, I could not find anywhere a way to be Mexican and queer. It was like, oh, if I'm going to be queer, which I obviously cannot deny at this point in my life, then I need to join this, like, 90s feminist, like, revolution of lesbians. And that's, like, that's where I'm going to get laid. you know, so, like, this was, like, the group of people that I could be around. And I didn't, and that, I think, was, like, you know, in high school, I had friends who were Mexican, and we would, like, speak in Spanish. And, you know, there was, like, a lot more kind of, like, diversity. But as I started to come out, my friend group became, like, extremely, extremely white. And I had a really hard time finding people of color who were queer that I could be friends with. It was, like, I felt like I had kind of to choose between one and the other. And I couldn't really find other examples. And then when I started, like, finding examples of people who were Mexican and who were white, they really didn't look like me. They had, like, slick gel back hair, long hair, you know, like, long hair Latina lesbian, like, with the boots and the heels and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, I'm too far gone. I'm not going to start growing my hair out, you know, so that I can fit into this kind of dynamic.
Soft butch.
Yeah. It was like, I felt like my option was to be, like, this kind of white soft butch. And then I would have to, like, always, you know, reveal my Mexicanness in that situation. I guess that's, like, what I feel like it made me even whiter, you know, like, coming out as gay made me, like, an even whiter person. And I had to kind of choose between, like, my cultural identity, my sexual identity.
Yeah. And we live in a time that is super interesting because depending on what part of the country you live in, it's safer to be queer, like, outwardly, like, visibly queer, than to be a person of color. And I just realized that recently. I always talk about RuPaul's Drag Race. I know that show is super problematic, but one of the drag queens on that show, Evie Oddly, she lives in Denver, and she's mixed, but she identifies as black. And she was talking in the behind-the-scenes show, Untucked, that she made a conscious decision as a teenager to be queer as fuck because, you know, dress all crazy, wear makeup to school, because it was safer for her to walk the streets of Denver as a queer than as a black person, right? So, that just, like, blew my mind. Like, I never even thought of that because to me, being a Latino, like, being gay is the worst thing ever, right? There's worse things. Excuse me. I don't think a lot of people take that experience, especially as a white person or a white passing person, into account.
It's about labeling.
Yeah.
And it's this enlightenment culture from the French that fuck us all up. That we somehow... I'm going to get philosophical here for a second. There's a philosopher, Emmanuel Levinas. He talks about encountering another person. And by the way, it's 500 year anniversary of the encounter of Cortes and Moctezuma.
Happy anniversary.
Hey. So I've been thinking a lot about encounters this year, in media, in my everyday interactions. The problem with romanticizing the encounter is, like, as soon as you meet somebody, you have that face-to-face, you want to find the similarities between you and that person. That's the problem number one. That's where empathy kicks in and doesn't do shit. So what we need to start doing is when we encounter another person, we need to understand their differences and celebrate them. And I'm going to learn from your differences, and you're going to learn from my differences. And we cannot do that to save ourselves. Nobody is able to do that. And I experienced it, for example, with my wedding. After my wedding, everybody's like, oh, I was so gay and so Mexican. I'm like, no, girl. Like, that's how you recognize me. That was just me. Like, the theme was Mexican movies, and that's it. It doesn't have to be super queer. It doesn't have to be super Mexican. It's just who I am. But because of that, because they wanted to recognize things that they understand about me and my wedding and my relationship, the wedding became labeled. And that's something that I think is the hardest thing for humans, because we are thought that empathy is this positive thing, right? But the reality is that empathy creates this fucking monster.
It's so dangerous because you can just say, oh, I feel so deeply for you, and you don't have to think about, like, the macro level systemic structures
exactly
that produce difference.
And a lot of white Latinos love to do that. You're like, oh, I understand your struggle because we're both Latinos. Like, no, absolutely not. And understanding those differences and learning from those differences, it's a live learning experience.
I think that's actually the most important thing. I participated in the Brown Artist Retreat in San Antonio over Christmas, and there was 40 other artists sitting in the room, and they're all introducing each other, and everybody's struggling with labels, like how to label themselves, Tejana, Mexicana, Latina, you know, whatever that might be. And it's like, I don't know, I'm more complex than that. I can't tell you I'm one thing. And like our daughters go to a dual language school. I mean, for me, it's important for them to have a sense of this. They live in Texas now. The culture is here that's different than where they where I'm from. I came from Kansas City. I just claim that as my hometown. And but like in Kansas City, I am definitely not Mexican enough for Kansas City. It has its own culture, its own segregated way of it being, and like I could not cross over in a weird way. And it was like I could not identify. I was not given the space, or I didn't give myself the space. But and I also think it's kind of dangerous to homogenize. Like, we want to be assimilated, or we want to be seen, but then at the same time, in order to do that, we have to become homogenous, and I don't want to do that.
And we push to choose a label, and every label has so much historical weight. Tejano versus Texan, two different, completely different things. And we forget that. We forget that the labels that we perform onto each other have so much historical weight. We tend to erase it in order to fit to this space or to fit in that space, because we like to other ourselves. And right now, it's the victim Olympics all over fucking social media. Ugh.
Yeah. When in Chilita Vinyl Club, when we were like trying to develop the bio for the club, it was really interesting, because when I joined, the kind of call to members was like, if you're Latinx, if you identify as Latinx, if you self-identify as Latinx, then this is for you. But then over time, the collective started being labeled as a POC DJ collective. And, you know, I was very, like, weird for me to be on stage and for them to be like, this is an all POC DJ collective. And I was like, whoa, hold up. Like, if this is for POC, like, then I belong in the role of an ally, because I'm not trying to fool anybody over here, you know, like. And so I had to have, like, conversations with people. It was like, is this for people who identify as Latinx, or is this for people who identify as of color? Because if it is, then I don't belong in this space, and I really want it to exist, but I don't want to, you know. And then I felt really weird, like, raising these questions and being like, what about me, guys? I'm white, you know? But I also was like, very, very, like, there was, like, I mean, you can ask my wife. There was, like, a lot of inner turmoil. Like, should I be in this collective or not? Like, is this for people who identify as Mexican or identify as Latinx? Or is this for people who like cumbias, because that's, like, everybody? Yeah. Or is this for, like, people who are Latinx and identify as a person of color? Because these are all very different things. And in some of them, I fit into the Venn diagram, and some of them, I just don't.
Yeah. And so one thing that I'm pushing now on our podcast, and just when I talk to people in general, like, hi, nice to meet you, I'm white. No, I just say, I like this, you know, this recognition of white privilege within the Latino community, because I think if people realize that they're white in white Latinos, then I think we will also start recognizing Afro-Latinos as Latinos. And that is when I feel like that is one of the biggest issues within the Latino community, is that the erasure of Black Latinos. And it's mostly white Latinos that erase them, right? Because they think that they're brown, so they just see it as, you know, this brown community, when Black Latinos are all over the world. I just went to Guatemala, and there's Black Guatemalans everywhere, and I had no idea, because my family never has talked about it, or I don't have a relative. So you know, it's they have been completely erased from a lot of our histories and a lot of you know, our media. So, you know, we have our Cardi B's out there, Amara La Negra, you know, but they don't represent the whole spectrum of Latinidad. So, yes, being a white Latino gives us privilege, and as long as we recognize it, I think we can really, you know, move forward as a culture.
So with that in mind, how do you ethically and responsibly perform your white Latinidad?
I mean, I would not necessarily say I'm the most ethical white Latino in the world, but I would say that, like, I spend a lot of time thinking about this, and I spend a lot of time reading about, you know, race and ethnicity and culture, and I try really hard to be an ally to my friends, you know, especially, like, for example, if we're in Chile Divino Club and some really annoying, like, white rocker dude comes up to, like, talk to us, I'm like, all right, guys, it's me, you know, like, I got this one, you know, like, this is my role. You know, like, that's a simple, you know, way, but I try to be like, okay, like, what can I do within this collective where I am the only person who's white in the collective, and how can I, like, help support us, but then, and also, like, help y'all to feel more comfortable by taking some of that burden.
It was funny because I grew up playing punk bands and we used to tour. We were getting gasoline outside of Chicago. Chicago's messed up. The guys were all scared to get out of the van and they made me go pay for the gas. And it's like, you go, you're the white guy. And like, because they were afraid that some shit was going to go down if they got seen outside of the van in the suburbs of Chicago. And so, like, those moments, I think, are where I'm an asset for the culture, where it's like I can get into the white spaces. So, like, my name gets me phone calls for resumes or shows, or I get, you know, I get the door open, and then I can, like, let everybody else in. That's how I see it. Because I know I if I wanted to, I probably could easily just be Rob Harrington, shave my head, shave my face, you know, whiten up, and just, like, cash in.
Yeah,
but I feel like there's a responsibility because of my family. I think I'm the whitest, but I have, like, everyone else looks dark. So somehow I was like the jewel, I guess, the güerito. That was like, mira güerito, güerito. Like, you know,
precioso.
Like, yeah, exactly. Wow.
Extra Christmas present.
Yeah, like all the tías like would pinch you, and like you were like this little.
There's even a saying that when there's like a light skinned Latino born into the family, it's, they said, oh, avanzando la raza, like, yeah, advancing the,
exactly,
race. And it's still a thing today.
And I know that I hold that as a responsibility, I feel like. So, like, when I curate shows, I'm always constantly aware of, like, I don't need to look at white artists. I mean, there's millions of other artists that need opportunities, and I'm going to try my best to give that, to open that door. So that's one way.
I agree with that, but then also, you know, the white savior complex is also very real. You know, I think I maybe overstep my boundaries sometimes, you know, trying to speak up for people, and I actually am more conscious of that now, and I'm doing the opposite. So when I'm in a space where, you know, I'm very loud usually and doing a lot of shit, but when I'm in a space and I'm seeing color and I'm seeing the power dynamics, I think now what I try to do the most is be quiet and sit back and let the women speak, let the people of color speak, because recognizing that dynamic, I think, is really important too. And so passing the mic, I think just giving other people the opportunity to talk or just being there as a supportive person. This happens in a lot of queer spaces too. Y'all, if there's any straight people here that go to gay bars, if you're not dancing, get the fuck off the dance floor. That is our space. Girl, I went to Barbarella the other night.
Reach.
Juice came on, Lizzo's song. I was like, I'm a big girl and I'm at a gay bar. Get the fuck out of here, you white dreadlock bitch, right? And so, oh my God, I can't believe, y'all, if you're a white person with dreads here, stop. Go shave your head. I'm saying this really loud because I'm in Austin. If you are a white person and have dreadlocks, stop. Okay.
Do we have time for questions?
No.
Okay.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Now
I'm going to be quiet.
I guess I always think about this in terms of being the person of power or privilege in the classroom. I really do.
Right.
I also think about, like, the type of child I want to raise. And to me, that's very, there's a similarity or a symbiosis between that or in those two relationships. And there's a lot of my, like, educator friends, when we're at conferences and things, the things that we're talking about are are things about democracy and spaces, and like Paulo Freire, and talking about giving, education, like giving you tools. Yeah, and so that is how I think about it, because for so long I didn't. It's like I was unaware, you know, and but I'm not anymore. And I think that's like the biggest tool I have. And so whenever I am in the classroom or with my own children, I think about the tools they need, the voice they, the agency, the sense of place that they need to be able to continue, because they may not know, you know, they may be the only one in their family to be going to school or to have this sort of stress, and they need the support. And so how to activate or how to access, that's how I think about it.
Right.
I like to think about stories and history a whole lot. And like, where is my place in lifting those and bringing them to the like the surface of emergence,
right.
Which is dangerous, because sometimes when you're doing that, you become the shield, like of a white institution. They're like, oh, send out the shield, she'll justify our choices. But it's interesting being back in Austin. My dissertation project is on this neighborhood, and thinking through what's like my ethical responsibility to the stories in that writing, and in the histories in that writing, and how, because of the privilege I have in terms of education and being white passing, like how can I create a space, like what's my responsibility for creating a space, producing a space to like lift those stories and sort of go to the back, like use your power of voice and your body and all of those things to create a space, but then get out of the way. But that's just like a practice of questioning. I don't know how to do it. I fail at it a lot. And at times I can choose not to think about it, which is also privilege.
All right. I think we have time for maybe just one quick question. Jaime Castillo.
What's up with the umbrellas? Are you afraid to
get it? Oh, girl. Y'all are cruel for this one, Fusebox. I see what you did, Betty. You put the white Latinos in the sun. Okay.
He did.
I think about language a lot, you know, when you're trying to, like, evolve your thinking or transform yourself, it's so important to be vigilant of language.
Right.
And it's interesting to me because, Justin, you used the word let. I think let is such a problematic word, you know, because instead of like get out the way, there's a huge difference there that's important to acknowledge.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I've just like, let implies like, kind of you're saying like, avanzo a raza. So now you're in a position to.
Giving them permission. Okay? Yeah, right. I see.
And that mirrors what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Question the whole structure. Doesn't disrupt it, you know. You just assume the position now. It's just so important to be vigilant of that and think more of like, I'm gonna get out the way, or like come up with some other word, but let perpetuates. It just switched the person.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. See, I'm white, I don't know. Thank you. Any other comments? I think we have time.
We were scared of getting a sunburn.
I get pimples like with direct sunlight. I have this absurd theory that since I'm half white, half Mexican, that it's the colonization happening through skin. So it's like when I'm exposed to sun, the white skin can't take it, and smallpox emerges, kind of, and is trying to destroy me. So that's I get really bad sunburn. I burn easily. Like I always burnt when we ever went swimming, like quemao, like little red lobster. And like the rest of the family, like they, it didn't matter. They would get like really, really dark. Like, but me, I suffer. So I need the shade.
All right. Well, with that being said,
delicate,
we gotta get out of the
guy.
We gotta get out of the sun, y'all. But thank you, thank you very much, everybody, for coming to this live episode of Latinos Who Burn, no, Who Lunch. Thank you again to our guests, Robert, a.k.a. Roberto, a.k.a. Don't Call Him Bobby, Rob.
You're welcome. Thank
you, Kara, my new best friend. Over here, Aaron, catch her at the next Chulita Vinyl Club gig.
Today, at the Contemporary.
And oh my gosh, Alex, thank you so much for being there. I love your art. Oh my gosh, what an awesome crew. Fabi Fav.
Pavelito.
Signing off. Thank you, Fusebox. You've been so amazing. Thank you, Austin. And thank you to everybody that helped me make this thing behind us. It was a lot. Thank you so much, Jake. Thank you, Mario, everybody.
And we're back. Thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone that made it to the Waffle Chat. Yeah, it was such an interesting conversation. I didn't realize it, but I was really nervous. Listening back to it, I was like, what the hell was I saying? But thank you so much to everyone. And, you know, Anna, Ron, Betty, Jessica, everybody at Fusebox Festival. What an amazing experience. From the doing the live shows to doing the installation. Yo, the installation took a village. So thank you to everybody that helped with that. A big shout out actually to my cousin Jasenia and her partner David. They came out from Vegas to help me. Oh, and Jake Austin, from the podcast Juice with Jake and Jake. He was helping me. So if you haven't listened to Juice with Jake and Jake, make sure you listen to that podcast. It's blowing up. It's so awesome. Anyway, Jake was there helping me also for the installation. I couldn't have done it without him and without my cousin. So I had to give y'all a shout out. Okay. Again, thank you to the panelists. I mean, what a great group of people, great friends. I mean, Robert, he is so awesome. He, again, has the Museum of Pocket Art. And if you want to find him, he is on social media. He's on Instagram at robert.jackson.harrington. And he's also the director of the Museum of Pocket Art. Google it, locas. And then Kara, oh my gosh, we became immediate best buddies. Kara E. Martinez, that's C-A-R-R-A E. Martinez on Instagram. And then Kara Martinez on Facebook. Alex, oh my gosh, Alex actually helped me with my installation in Houston, Texas. She came out all the way from Austin to help me. Thank you so much, Alex. And you can find Alex at ALXROB on Instagram and the ALXROB on Twitter. And Aaron Gentry, Irlanda, thank you so much for the panel. And oh my gosh, if y'all haven't seen the Chulita Vinyl Club yet, they are all over the place. I just saw the Chulita Vinyl Club Austin chapter spin in New York at the Brooklyn Museum. It was so awesome. Anyways, you can check out Mass Gallery, which Aaron is a part of, at massgallery.org. All right, so just a few quick announcements. I am currently in Santa Cruz, California. Right now, doing a big installation at the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. If you want to come through and help, you can, or just come to check out the process. I'm going to be doing that the next week. The show opens July 5th here in Santa Cruz. I'm recreating this old mural that was erased by Chicano artist Eduardo Carrillo back in the 70s, actually in the building right next door to where we are, which is super interesting. But the exhibition is called Regeneración. There's a link in the bio of my Instagram at FaviFav if you want to check that out. Also, in July, I'll be back in Las Vegas and I will be doing a big workshop with the Marjorie Barrick Museum of Art on July 20th. So July 20th, 12 to 5 p.m., come through. And then also, at 5:30 p.m., they're going to be screening that state-of-the-art documentary we've talked about before that I'm a part of at the museum. So if you didn't catch it on PBS, they're going to be playing it at the Marjorie Barrick Museum on July 20th for their community day. Come through, y'all. Come through. Okay, I think that's all. Next week, we're going to bring you another live episode, live at the Barrick Museum, actually. And that was super fun. We talked about media representation, Latinx media representation, with Dr. Erica Abad, who has been on our show before. So maybe if you haven't listened to her episode, go back to episode titled Erica Gets the Job Done. And that's Erica with a K. And to get ready for this next episode. Okay, that's it. As always, you can visit us at latinoswholunch.com. Send your emails to asklwl@gmail.com. If you have a moment, please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. 5 stars. 5 stars only, because the more reviews we have, the more visible we are, and visibility leads to representation, and representation matters, people. All right. Today's episode was edited and produced by me, Justin Favela. The music that you're listening to is by the band Brownout. I'm Fabi Fav. Bye.